cure autism. I like people with autism, but I do want to help people with autism be comfortable in the life that they choose to live and to have the skills that they want.
Well, Leslie Daniel, this is fascinating. Thank you for sharing with me, and with good reason.
Thank you for having me.
Leslie Daniel is a professor of special education at Radford University and teaches in the Autism Studies Certificate Program. This is With Good Reason. We'll be right back. Welcome back to With Good Reason from Virginia Humanities. At about 3 p.m., fast food restaurants across the country start filling up with teenagers. Burgers and fries seem to go hand in hand with kids. What is it that draws them to fast food joints? To learn more about the eating habits of teenagers, George Mason University sociologist Amy Best went straight to the source. Through careful observation in cafeterias and fast food joints, Best gained some insights into why kids eat what they eat and ways to push them to make better choices. Amy, where were you when you first started thinking about kids and fast food?
I was actually at a fast food restaurant.
Because you were hungry or because you were observing?
I actually went there just to eat, and I got myself some food, and I was sitting down to do some grading, and I looked around, and it was right at the end of the school day, and all of a sudden, there was just a flood of kids. And I had just come off of another research project, and I thought, wow, what's going on here? This is really interesting. And I went back a couple more times, and then I thought, I wonder if it's like this in other places.
What did you notice about kids who go to Chipotle? What was happening as they were enjoying meals in groups?
I noticed lots of food talk that was really interesting about kids' identities as girls and boys. I saw lots of food sharing that seemed to be about friendships and friendship groups. I saw lots of gifting that was occurring. Interestingly, I did not see a lot of gifting that went from boys to girls, but I saw lots that went from girls to boys, and I saw some that went from boys to boys.
Oh, and girls to girls, of course.
Of course.
What do you make of the way girls see food and the way boys see food when it comes to sharing?
So boys don't always want to share their food.
Yeah.
And girls were much more willing to share their food. In fact, one time I was in a school, it was a school where kids, the only way they could gain access to soda was by bringing it in from home. And there was a boy had a can of soda, which he didn't want. It was a Coca-Cola, and he offered it to a girl. And a girl, with such surprise, said, "Me?" And he ended up giving it to her, and she received it very happily as a gift from him. And that was one of the only occasions that I watched a boy give food to a girl. Now, for me, I think this is about how girls learn to be the givers of food, and boys learn to be the receivers of food.
You went to a number of restaurants. In particular, which fast food places did you tend to observe?
So in the beginning, I went to lots of different places. Chipotle, Baskin-Robbins, Dairy Queen, Panera, McDonald's, of course. And I ended up narrowing my focus and spent time in four different McDonald's, all a close walk within a block of high schools. In fact, I will often joke that if you want to find a McDonald's, all you need to do is find a high school.
Really?
They are in close distance. And then I also went to Chipotle and really focused on one Chipotle and these few McDonald's and found these very interesting scenes. So one of the McDonald's that I went to, which is across the street from a school that primarily serves upper-income kids, it's in a wealthy community. I got there expecting to see kids after school because I had seen kids after school in these other McDonald's, only to find that there was mostly retired immigrant populations there. McDonald's didn't have a lot of appeal for these kids. And when I talked to them in interviews, I found that most of the girls said, "Ugh, McDonald's, that's unhealthy. That might be okay for boys, but we wouldn't go there."
Where'd you find they were going?
So they would go to what I would consider the higher end fast food. There's fast food that's made with organic ingredients and sustainable meats. And then there's fast food that is sort of the standard mass-produced fast food. where health considerations are not really on the menu.
What did you come to see over these months of hanging out with kids, hanging out in fast food places, that regardless of income seemed to be the draw?
Yeah, so food spaces are inexpensive to access for most kids. You can go to a McDonald's and actually not buy anything, which is unlike other kinds of sit-down restaurants where you are really expected to order something off the menu. But McDonald's, you don't need to do that. And so that means that access is pretty easy for them. And for lots of these places, it's pretty inexpensive, even if you are buying French fries or a burger. And that has a lot of appeal for young folks whose disposable income has grown, but they don't have the same kind of disposable income that working parents have. And so they are looking for spaces where they can spend time that's outside of school and outside of home. And these commercial places are appealing in that regard.
You spent so much time watching them. Did you come to realize that actually it's super good for them to have these spaces?
Yes. These are places where kids go and they chit-chat about life. There's a kind of performance in play at these places. Some of these places get really, really rowdy after school, which is really interesting. I mean, I think that parents are sort of, and other adults are kind of running for the hills. They walk in and maybe turn around because they see that these are places that are sort of overrun by teenagers. And that's part of the appeal for young folks, too, is to be in a space. Most of the adults in these settings are behind counters. They're not at the tables with kids. And so they become these opportunities for kids to really do the work of being a teenager. And sometimes we forget that a really central part of doing the work of a teenager is figuring out who you are. And peers are really important to that.
At some point, you started to talk to the kids about what their relationship with food was at home, how their families share meals or don't.
Right. And then there was a lot of, they had a lot to say. And in a nutshell, what I found is that it's really, really hard for families today across the income spectrum to get a meal on the table, certainly every day. And that a lot of families are outsourcing or going to places outside of home to get a meal. And some of that is driven by the fact that parents work and whether you're talking about a family where you have one parent or you're talking about a family with two parents, parents are working. But we know that. I think what we're less aware of is that kids' lives have grown busier and busier in the last decades. And that is particularly pronounced for upper-income kids. And that's one of the reasons why you see upper-income kids spending more time in fast food restaurants, even though they're not marketed as aggressively as lower-income kids.
Do you see more upper-income kids in fast food restaurants?
Well, I do, yeah. But there is some interesting data that's not a part of my own data, but I did find that my interviews supported what the U.S. Census has found through their American Community Survey, which is that the lower the income, the greater likelihood to eat at home with your younger children. And that the higher the income, the greater likelihood to not eat at home.
You did so much of your watching children eating and conversing and being with each other in school over meals and in fast food places over meals. What did you notice about the healthiness of the options available to them, or what they chose or what they understood?
I think the assumption is that kids, when they're in school, don't eat healthy food. And I did not find that. So one of the things that I did when I was in the schools, and I've spent lots of time in high schools, but also elementary schools, is I spend time looking through the garbage to see what gets thrown out. And I find that when you give a 6 or 7-year-old a pear that has not been cut up, that pear will go in the garbage. But if you give a 6 or 7-year-old a pear or an orange that has been sliced and is easy for them to eat, they will eat it. We know that young people, when they're surveyed, that they do prioritize fresh fruit and, well, less vegetables, but fresh fruits in school over things like soda and candy. And one of the schools that I observed, one of the lunch ladies took me through the way that they had set up the salad bar. They had made sure to have the vegetables be in the front row and all of the goodies like the dried cranberries and breadcrumbs in the back. because they had found from the research that they did is that if you put the vegetables first, kids are more likely to take them. Mm. And so that was like a really thoughtful effort on the part of this school to prioritize vegetables with good effect.
You also talked with a lot of organizations trying to get kids to eat healthier and teach them and show them. Anything else that you can share with us that you learned from this amazing immersion in the world of children and food?
So I would say this. There's, you know, food's on our mind. And we have spent a lot of time in the last, I don't know, since 2008, talking about how to get kids to eat healthier foods. And I think that programs that deal with the sort of intangibles, programs that can build in meaningful shared rituals, like one of the programs I observed, all of the kids, when they tried new food, they always took the first bite together. And that was just a rule. And it was so effective in creating a shared moment for those kids that they all would bite together. They would offer an evaluation. And what I found is that those kids asked for seconds and they asked for thirds, and it really didn't matter what they were eating.
Fascinating. Amy Best, thank you for talking with me on With Good Reason.
My pleasure.
Amy Best is a sociologist at George Mason University. Her book on the subject is called Fast Food Kids, French Fries, Lunch Lines, and Social Ties. Coming up next, why cocooning after concussion should be a thing of the past. If you ever got a concussion as a kid, doctors might have recommended cocooning. That's staying in a dark room, no reading, no TV. Don't use your brain at all. My next guest, Bob O'Connor, is chair of the University of Virginia's Department of Emergency Medicine. He's recently published new guidelines that say kids should actually return to normal activity as soon as possible after concussion. Bob, what exactly is a concussion? Can you ever just get a hard knock in your head and not have had a concussion?
Well, that's what a concussion is. It's a hard knock in the head, whether it's a headache or variable symptoms. The person may be knocked unconscious. So pretty much any hard knock to the head is a concussion.
What about teenagers who do headers in soccer? Are those always concussions?
Well, that's a great question. We're wondering if the cumulative effect of headers repeated 1,000 times over a soccer career could have some effect. That plus soccer players tend to be going head first for the ball. And when two players get there at the same time, guess what happens? They knock heads. And that's how soccer is really one of the big sports where concussions happen. If people get multiple mild concussions back to back, that could have a more severe effect than a traumatic brain injury even, or a severe concussion.
What can happen to the brain? Most likely it's what? Brain bleeding?
It could be brain bleeding. That's a more severe form of head injury that we talk about. Concussions more or less may not involve bleeding. It may just be a knock to the head where someone is unconscious for a few seconds, or they may have headaches afterwards or some other symptom. They may have trouble focusing on a computer screen. They may have trouble concentrating in class.
So if their brain didn't bleed, what happened in their brain that led them to hurt or not focus or have double vision?
Yeah, the brain, whenever that happens, we think that there's some shearing force that happens where neurons are actually disrupted in part of the brain. Now, the brain will heal and people do recover from concussions, but it's important during that time period to minimize the subsequent injury and really promote the healing process.
Is most of the damage done when we hurt the front of our head? I assume most of our head injuries are to the forehead and up near the sides. And are those the only injuries that give us concussions?
Pretty much any strike to the head, anywhere. I think, you know, people tend to think of blows to the side of the head as being more severe, but it's, you know, it's really any part of the brain that could be hit. You know, I saw a college student who was 18 years old, who slipped on the stairs and her feet went out from under her and she struck the back of her head. So she had a concussion because when she came in, she was experiencing headaches, had vomited a couple times. She was there with her mom, who drove from their home to come down and see her because of what happened. And I think after her mother heard the symptoms and how the injury occurred, that they brought her into the hospital to get checked out. So by the time we saw her, she was awake, alert, was able to converse, seemed to be thinking fairly clearly. So it's a classic case of a mild concussion, you would think, because she was able to be discharged without any further workup, and we just watched her.
Are children more vulnerable to the effects of having had a blow to the head than grown-ups are?
We're much more concerned about. We think that children are more susceptible, especially during development. It's hard to prove that one way or the other. I think all ages are susceptible to concussion. What we're worried about with children is that the concussion, we want to make sure that they have time to recover from it before they resume sports activities or resume other activities that might result in a concussion. But we think the children are more sensitive to it.
What prompted you and others to come out with the latest new guidelines? There are 5 specific recommendations that you're making. Why did you decide, let's change the rules?
Well, we didn't so much change the rules as we tried to find every available bit of evidence that was out there. We didn't create any new information. We tried to instead distill all the information that was out there into one set of guidelines. And the reason we did that is because there was so much confusion on the part of parents and healthcare providers over how do you properly manage these. And there's also a renewed interest in it. You know, concussion is an area that is a very hot topic now, especially because of boxing, professional football, childhood soccer, you know, high school soccer injuries are a big one. Ice hockey is another one.
What was the confusion before? What sorts of things were doctors uncertain about when it came to evaluating somebody who might have a concussion?
Well, there's earlier in my career, when CT scans became very widespread, we had a very low threshold for using the CAT scan to image patients. I think we did a lot in cases that were not necessary. Over the subsequent years, we've been able to develop guidelines that better predict who will have a finding on CAT scans so that we could forego imaging in a lot of patients with minor concussions.
So new recommendation number one is, especially with children, do not just automatically x-ray.
That's correct. We want to do a much more disciplined approach where we evaluate them for high risk factors. And in the absence of those, the risk of finding something on CAT scan is virtually zero. So we instead have the parents follow up after discharge with their pediatrician to watch the child for development of subsequent vomiting, severe headache, other worrisome symptoms.
What is the test that you routinely do with children short of x-raying their brains?
Well, we do a complete history and physical exam. You want to make sure that there wasn't a prolonged loss of consciousness, that they hadn't experienced repeated vomiting at the scene, that their mental status was normal prior to arrival. Then you do a physical exam, which consists of looking at their motor activity, their speech.
Have you ever done that and gotten slurred speech?
Yes. Or in severe cases, you'd have someone who's just making no sense. You ask them what they had for lunch, and their response is something different.
And that's very concerning.
That's very concerning. And usually in those children, then we will go ahead with imaging. Or if they can't follow simple commands, such as raise your right hand, or touch your nose, or move your left foot, then we would go ahead with scanning.
What about for babies who can't respond to your questions?
Right. For children who aren't verbal, then we will look at how they're feeding, what they're how content they appear, how consolable they are with the mother. We'll ask the parents if they seem like they're behaving normally. You can't talk to them when they're pre-verbal, but you can observe simple things.
Of the 5, the recommendation that surprised me the most is the one where you say that children should return to normal activity in 2 or 3 days at the most after a concussion. I feel like there was a period where we were recommending a longer sort of cocooning stage where they lie absolutely still and do nothing.
It's the other part of why we looked at these guidelines is to try to answer that question, because it used to be that it was recommended that they experience cognitive rest. That was the term that the healthcare professionals use. What that means is you want to limit exposure to computers, anything that requires thinking or I don't think it's even achievable to get to that point. So what we're recommending is that the child resume normal activities within 2 or 3 days, but then if some activity causes a recurrence of symptoms, for example, if when they're on the computer they experience a headache, that we have them limit that activity but resume everything else.
And what about returning to actual sports and really hardcore activities?
Yeah, that's a bigger question. And there I would recommend rest until some period of time that they were deemed normal on follow-up with their doctor. Usually, again, there's not evidence to say that 2 weeks is better than 3 weeks, but there's some period of time when they should rest after a concussion. And a lot depends on the severity of the concussion, too. If they experience loss of consciousness, amnesia, or having prolonged headaches or other symptoms afterwards, then I think most doctors would recommend a longer duration of rest.
You mentioned earlier back-to-back concussions. Is it dramatically more harmful when they come in close succession like that?
Yeah, the thinking is that they really are, that the cumulative effect of two back-to-back concussions is worse than either one alone or worse than a more severe one to begin with. Most of the evidence indicates that the people who suffer from long-term consequences of concussion have had back-to-back ones. Certainly the symptoms in the second one are more severe.
How many years have you treated young people in emergency rooms?
About 32 years.
You know, after seeing all these children over all those years, have you concluded, my kids are never going to play blank?
Great question. I was thinking about putting them in bubble wrap when they were born, but that's it's obviously never going to happen.
Yeah.
I did experience this with my son. I was at home one day. He was out just learning how to ride a bike, and my neighbor came running up to the front door with my son, and the bike's laying in the middle of the street. And the neighbor told me that my son had run into the mailbox, and he was wearing a helmet. And he hands me the helmet, and there's this giant dent in the helmet that clearly would have caused a scalp laceration or some other injury, and he had absolutely no injury.
Huh. What's your best advice for preventing concussions?
That's where all this, it's not really in the guidelines, but the basic thing is to prevent the concussion from happening in the first place. If you think of the example with my son wearing a helmet, obviously helmets are key if you're, say, skiing, snowboarding, cycling, engaged in some sport where there's a chance that you might fall and hit your head. The other thing that people don't necessarily think of in the context of concussion prevention are car seats. I, of course, advise all parents to have age-appropriate car seats for their kids, because even with a motor vehicle crash, the chance of a concussion is much higher if they're not properly restrained, plus the chance of more serious injury is much higher. So I'd say absolutely prevention is the key. So I'd like to be at the point where I never see the child who bangs their head because they were wearing a helmet.
Bob O'Connor is chair of the University of Virginia's Department of Emergency Medicine. Virginia Humanities has a new paid fellowship opportunity for educators committed to creating inclusive learning experiences for a Virginia K-12 classroom. Selected candidates will be funded through a National Endowment for the Humanities Sustaining the Humanities grant. Applications are due by January 7th. Please find more at virginiahumanities.org. With Good Reason is produced by Virginia Humanities, which acknowledges the Monacan Nation, the original people of the land and waters of our home in Charlottesville, Virginia. Our production team is Allison Quantz, Matt Darrow, Lauren Francis, and Jamal Milner. Maya Neer and Cassandra Deering are our interns. For the podcast, go to withgoodreasonradio.org. I'm Sarah McConnell. Happy holidays from all of us here at With Good Reason, and thanks for listening.
There's no sense in house. Thank you. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 9:59 a.m. Next up is a news show called American Standoff, hosted by Jacqueline Keeler.